From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An historic vote is scheduled in Congress. The House expected to decide on a Republican-led overhaul of the health care system. But there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing today. GOP leaders don't know if they've got the votes. President Trump spoke to reporters briefly this morning.
Do you think it's going to pass?
See what happens.
Did you rush it?
Thank you. We'll see what happens.
Thank you.
Well, we're learning Vice President Mike Pence even canceled his travel plans today to work the phones. Joining us now, NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, we've also been following your Twitter feed. There's been reports that Speaker Paul Ryan went to the White House. What's going on?
Good afternoon, Robin. Nice to chat with you.
Yes.
You know, it is there's a lot of moving parts here. You know, they voted only at around 11:15 or so to get the rules going for how they're even going to have this debate. But what we know at this hour is that Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, has headed to the White House to update President Trump on the latest with the bill. And right now, that doesn't sound very promising for Republicans. You know, you don't want to – the people still have to vote. You don't want to prejudge what might come. But there have been a couple of key defections so far. You have the Appropriations Committee chairman from New Jersey, Congressman Frelinghuysen, who's come out and said that he's a no on this bill. Barbara Comstock from Northern Virginia now saying she's a no as well. She's fairly close to House Speaker Paul Ryan and is in a district that Hillary Clinton had won. So you're starting to see some of these moderates peel off after what happened last night with the essential health benefits provision, which essentially is the regulation that requires insurance companies to cover certain levels of health coverage. The Freedom Caucus, this sort of almost 40 members who are very hardline Republicans, wanted the essential health benefits or EHBs to be reduced so that that would bring premiums down. But, you know, it's a little bit like whack-a-mole or one of those water balloons. You squeeze one end and the other pops open.
Right.
And that's part of the problem with trying to corral these votes right now.
Well, there are lawmakers who passionately believe in some of the things that they're asking for. You know, they passionately believe in elements of healthcare that they want to see in place or in spending that they don't want to see. I mean, I don't want to take away from the passion behind this. What about the politics? We have the Quinnipiac poll that's come out that show a majority of voters oppose the health care bill, something like 3-1. You have the Congressional Budget Office new scoring of the new changed Republican bill saying it would cost even more and as many people, 24 million, would still lose their coverage down the road. So are Republicans in particular looking at that and saying, this is not worth us lining up behind this president?
Well, it's a very complicated political situation here that you have because you have these most ideological Republicans within that Freedom Caucus, the 38 or 40 or so that exist, who really could tank this bill if they go if they go lockstep together, who are in districts where President Trump did quite well, and they feel ideologically that this bill doesn't line up with what they believe, given what you've just outlined in a lot of ways, and they are against the bill because of those ideological reasons. President Trump, though, having done well in those districts, had threatened this lever against them to say, if you don't work on this, if you don't get this done, then it could be political problems in your districts, and he's just going to let Obamacare stand. Well, you know, to the point of your public polling point, you know, when you have 17% of the country saying that they approve of the AHCA, the American Health Care Act, which is what the Republican bill is called, and you have only 61% of Republicans in favor of it, then, you know, moderates start looking at those numbers and realize they could be in jeopardy too if they are one of those 23 to 25 or so who would be vulnerable in 2018.
Yeah. Well, Senator Rand Paul is one of many saying that this is just a move out of Donald Trump's book on negotiating. You know, last night, take it or leave it. Get up from the table and walk away. The art of the deal. But are we seeing here, as others have also said, that this doesn't transfer to politics?
Well, it's not as easy because, you know, President Trump likes to talk about bilateral trade agreements and bilateral business deals. You know, this is as multilateral as it gets. You know, you've got 435 total members. You have 237 Republicans from very different kinds of districts and very different kinds of political calculations that they need to make. So it's very difficult. And this is a game of chess trying to get these folks through. You know, John Boehner, when he was Speaker of the House, used to say that his job was hard. It was like trying to squeeze 218 frogs in a wheelbarrow. And, you know, you'd get able to get one in and a few others jump out somewhere else. And that is problematic. It's very difficult. This is very difficult work.
Well, of course, if President Trump, if Paul Ryan are able to get the votes for this bill, huge victory for them. So we'll keep an eye on it. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. We'll be watching it as it goes.
Yep.
Well, earlier today, I spoke with Congressman Robert Pittenger of North Carolina. He's a Republican who is supporting the American Health Care Act. And I started our conversation by asking him if he thinks Republicans have the votes they need to pass it.
I'm not sure that we have the votes yet. We need to come and have consensus and understand that each person comes with their own constituency group. And you can't always come to the table demanding everything that you want.
Well, you say you're not sure you have the votes. How do the stakes feel to you? Does it feel like if Republicans cannot pass this bill, that that's going to be a major blow to the agenda?
Oh, sure. I think you're exactly right. It's a blow, frankly, to the American people. The carriers of health care, they're pulling out. Aetna said it's on a death spiral. Humana said they'll be out by 2018, and many others have already pulled out. It never did have the capacity to work. And so we're seeing the effects of that now with the premiums and the deductibles escalating.
Are Republicans, if this bill fails, going to try to fix those pieces of Obamacare and just work within the system or try again to repeal?
Well, right now our interest is to see if we pass it. If it doesn't pass, there's other things on our agenda that we want to do. And there has to be understanding by the Democrat Party as well that in their best efforts and their well intentions, the Obamacare was a financial failure. And they should then be willing to come to the table and say, hey, you know, we need to fix this problem. And we do it in a bipartisan way. So I'm all for that. We need to reform it. We've got to have competitive markets. That's what drives prices down. And the American people really want choices in their health care. They don't want to be mandated. So there's many provisions of this bill that are really good.
Okay, well, let's explore the other option here, which is that instead of the bill failing in the House, it passes and maybe even gets through the Senate in some form. Are you worried about what the Congressional Budget Office has said, which is that 24 million people are going to lose their insurance over 10 years?
Well, I guess I would have to take that, Jeremy, in context with their projections for people who would enroll was right at 18 or 19 million, and instead there's 11 million. The cost of Medicaid went up exponentially, far more than what they thought it was going to be. So the numbers haven't been really accurate. One thing that they don't factor in, because they don't have that in their database, is the impact of open markets if competing across state lines. Right now you have 50 separate insurance markets that are non-competitive. That's why in North Carolina we essentially just have one carrier. Many third of the counties in the country only have one carrier. They don't factor in the impact of the 1,200 rules and regulations that have been written in there in the bill that the Secretary of Health and Human Services has the ability to reform and eliminate. Even they said on page 25 and 26 of their report that the outcomes will vary significantly based on a number of variables.
So do you believe that nobody is going to lose their health insurance under the GOP plan?
Well, I don't think you can say that at all. But I think what it will be is a more affordable plan when your premiums are going up 25% a year. And you really don't have coverage, Jeremy, if you have a deductible that's, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000, and you're making $50,000 a year. That doesn't work.
Do you think that Speaker Ryan will remain in place if this bill fails?
Sure. He has a very tough job. It's herding cats. You have, on our side of the aisle alone, you have 240 members, and they all have different views. They all have different constituency groups that they represent. So the objective is to come together and build a consensus. And that was the genius of Ronald Reagan. You can't come to the table and demand 100% of what you want. Reagan used to say, I'll take 80% and be happy with that. You can't just come with your ideology. I'm a very conservative guy, but I can't come and say, well, I have to have it my way or the highway. I think Mr. Trump did all that he could to build bridges. There's 100 different members of Congress who came over to the White House to see him or Vice President Pence. So he worked hard on that. And if we can't get there, well, it's unfortunate for the American people.
That's Congressman Robert Pittenger, Republican of North Carolina, and a yes vote on the health care bill. Congressman, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
A tweet from the White House is causing an uproar, and this time it's from Vice President Mike Pence. He tweeted a photo yesterday of lawmakers negotiating parts of the Republican health care bill. But what people noticed, the men in the room were talking about eliminating requirements that insurance policies cover pregnancy or maternity and newborn care without a single woman in the room, at least in the photo. Femi Oke is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us to look at how this and other news stories are percolating online. Femi, what were the comments?
Well, the actual tweet from the vice president was fairly boring, actually. He said, appreciated joining at POTUS for a meeting with the Freedom Caucus again today. This is it, hashtag pass the bill. And the House Freedom Caucus is a group of Republican, conservative Republican lawmakers. So they were all gathered. So my description would be a long brown table, men around the table, men stacked against the wall, men standing up. That is a
men.
That's my description. But let me give you some of Twitter's descriptions, so much more interesting and colourful. At Claire W says, a room full of white men in the same grey suit. And then we have...
It was.
They didn't have the same grey suit, but it did look very monochrome. Senator Patty Murray says, a rare look inside the GOP's Women Health Caucus. Read between the lines there.
Okay, we'll get one more.
Yeah. All right. This is the most colourful one. Elisa Gambino, and I went to Facebook for this, said, not a vagina in the room, but I see plenty of boobs.
Okay. All righty then. Ba-dum-bum. Well, about 5 hours later, the vice president tweeted out two more pictures from a different healthcare meeting. These photos each had a woman in
it.
So an effort there to fix the optics. Let's move on. A lot of online reaction to the administration's rule that'll prevent air travelers from 10 Middle Eastern countries from carrying devices larger than a cell phone on two planes. Now, this is about to take effect. A lot of response online to this.
Absolutely. Airlines, first of all, they responded very quickly and with a lot of humor as well. So let me give you an Emirates ad that came out this week with Jennifer Aniston. Mm. And she says, who needs tablets and laptops anyway? Relaxing and looking at the in-house entertainment. There's lots of games to play. She's having a great time.
You know, I have to say, I saw that ad. It catches your eye because it looks like she's at a resort and she's on an airplane.
Exactly. Yeah. And then at Royal Jordanian, you really should go and look at their Twitter feed there because it is hilarious. Let me share one with you, a tweet that they sent today. 12 things to do on a 12-hour flight with no laptop or tablet. And there is entertainment there for you to do, like taking a light snack, watching the entertainment. You can even stare at your companion. So those are kind of very humorous. And ITA actually says for their airline, making flying great again. So a little bit of a troll there in their ad. But online, so those were the airlines, but I'm talking about people who are actually flying.
Right.
So journalists like Molly Crabapple was saying, I fly backwards and forwards from the US to Turkey. I need to work on the plane. So this is very problematic for me. And then at Elder Shan pointed out something that a lot of people on Twitter pointed out. Every criminal in the Middle East is saying, oh no, we can't take the direct flight to the US. I hate connecting flights. Cancels criminal plans. So there is a flaw to this electronics ban.
Right. You could take a connecting flight. Well, we should say officials in the U.S. say this is a response to intelligence that shows that terrorists might be trying to carry out attacks using these consumer items. Look, I just want to touch on this Russian presidential candidate, an opponent of Vladimir Putin, video posted online. He took it. He took a selfie. He was attacked, but thankfully it was just some green dye on his face. So he took a selfie. What's happened?
He had antiseptic thrown at his face. This antiseptic, when it touches your skin, turns bright green. Mm. His face is currently bright green. His hands are bright green. He is saying, this is Alexei Navalny, a very famous opposition leader, saying the Kremlin is responsible, but it will not stop him from rallying. So he says, it doesn't make a difference. I look like a superhero. I'm having trouble getting the green off my teeth, but still come out on March 26. We will not stop rallying.
Well, and a lot of his followers are putting green on their face. We just want to touch on one last thing. Speaking of social media, Femi, in this segment, we got a peek today at some new emojis. They're going to become part of our digital lives in June. They'll be added by the Unicode Consortium. They rule emojis. Older woman with glasses and gray hair. A woman with a headscarf.
A beard. Okay, so we're looking at diversity here.
Wait, a woman with a beard?
Well, you could perhaps play around with Photoshop, but a man with a beard, seniors we're seeing, a little bit more diversity, mere people, so mere man, mere women as well, mere maids.
M-E-R, mere people.
Yes, okay. Yeah, mere people. And zombies.
Breastfeeding
so
mother.
So many more things. Breastfeeding mum, and that was really very heavily lobbied for last year. And then food, more food. There'd be tacos, fortune cookies, cheese.
Okay. More to play with. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
Okay. We do have one more social media note, and it's a serious one. The founder of the neo-Nazi website, The Daily Stormer, is asking supporters to use the hashtag I'll Ride With You and accompany white supremacists to work to protect them from discrimination. Now, this is because the New York City police say that a man that police are calling a white supremacist told them that he traveled to New York from Baltimore with the intent of killing as many black men as he could, and he confessed to killing one, 66-year-old Timothy Kaufman, on Monday night. The Daily Stormer founder Andrew Anglin says 28-year-old James Harris Jackson, the suspect, does not represent his religion of white supremacy. Well, white supremacists are upset, but our next guest asks, why aren't others? New York Times columnist Jim Dwyer joins us now. And Jim, the title of your piece today is Another Murderer Crazed by Color, This Time Met by Silence. Flesh that out. What do you mean?
About 2 years ago, December of 2015, a man came up from Baltimore armed to the teeth and came to Brooklyn and walked up to a police car and shot the officers in cold-blooded ambush.
Terrible.
And he was entirely motivated by hate of cops. And all he could see was blue. As it happened, he killed a Latino and an Asian cop. To me, it seemed very striking that after that terrible episode, there was enormous amounts of recriminations from big public figures in New York, including the former governor and the former mayor and others, and front pages in many of the papers, attacking, among others, Mayor de Blasio, President Obama, Attorney General Holder at the time, all of them being implicated, according to these critics, because they had been supportive of some of the reforms that were being proposed about police and citizen interaction in the wake of some of the shootings like the one in South Carolina and elsewhere. So this time around, nobody said boo.
Well, we should say that today, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio did call the attack a domestic terrorist attack. He was speaking on the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC. But you're right. We've even had these discussions in our meetings. You know, we should be doing this story. And there's just a wave of other news, as you know.
Yeah, there is a wave of other news. And it's, you know, always convenient to find something to distract us from a really horrible subject. This case involves a man. We don't know a lot about his background, the person who's been accused of the crime, but he seems to have been harboring this really anti-black rage for a while. The cops and prosecutors say he was upset about white women mixing with black men. And he's now reached a point where he could, you know, feel himself free to come to New York and murder a person in a really horrible way. I mean, not that there's any good way to do it, but he, you know, he came up with a sword and stabbed this poor man who was just walking along the street collecting cans. And he had intentions, at least what he told the police, so we're informed, that he would go to Times Square and kill more black men.
Now, this is the man that he killed, 66-year-old Timothy Kaufman, you know, a genial, well-known man in his neighborhood who volunteered, who lived in the same home that his, I think his pastor father had lived in, who was collecting cans. So you point out there's not enough attention being paid to this man's life, Timothy Kaufman, who was killed. But also the way many people are treating James Jackson, who again said he came to New York to kill black men, is by asking if it's a mental health issue. You make the point that others have made that when it's a white person killing in hatred, people ask if it's mental health. They don't tend to ask that of a black person killing in hatred.
Well, look, the man who killed the two cops had actually tried to commit suicide that day himself. So he clearly was deranged. And what was driving him? Those are valid subjects for investigation. I don't think the president of the United States was, but, you know, some people did. What is driving James Henry Jackson? Is it tolerance of white nationalists in powerful positions in the government and elsewhere?
Well, actually, let's go further. You write, during the campaign, Donald Trump retweeted false statistics from a white supremacist website. He claimed that President Obama was not born in America. He has been supported by white supremacist groups and white supremacists, including David Duke. Are you asking if there's a line from Donald Trump directly to James Jackson?
I'm asking, are we creating a climate where this kind of hateful intolerance has become acceptable in the minds of extreme people, people on the fringes like this guy seemingly was?
Well, and you're also asking, why aren't more of us paying attention? And we did today. Jim Dwyer, thank you. We'll post Jim's column at hereandnow.org. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
Today, I'm pleased to announce the official approval of the presidential permit for the Keystone XL pipeline.
That was President Trump today clearing the way for construction on the remaining portion of one of the most controversial pipeline projects in America. The $8 billion pipeline had been stopped by the Obama administration. Climate activists responded today saying Trump is moving backwards on climate and energy. But TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, called the decision a milestone. Joining us now is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. He's in New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, what does today's permit mean? Is construction on the pipeline going to start soon, or will there still be more legal battles?
You know, it obviously is a big hurdle to clear, but there still will be some other hurdles it has to clear. Opponents have vowed legal challenges, and from the sounds of it, they plan to make their opposition much more vocal on the local level at places like town meetings and whatnot. And TransCanada, who's building the pipeline, still needs state approval, which has been a sticking point, especially in Nebraska, where landowners have put up a pretty fierce fight against the project and have already forced some changes to it.
Now, President Trump signed an executive order recently requiring new pipelines or pipeline repairs to use U.S. steel. Does this pipeline have to meet that requirement?
Actually, this one does not fall under that executive order. But that said, TransCanada has promised to increase the amount of U.S. steel it uses in the construction of it. They've promised to add about another 200 miles worth of pipe made out of U.S. steel as part of the project.
The proponents of the Keystone Pipeline have said this is going to create a lot of jobs. Now, the nearly 2,000-mile-long pipeline would carry oil from Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas, and there has been a lot of debate about just how many jobs would be created. So now that this permit has been approved, what do we know about what the job creation will be?
Well, the construction of the pipeline itself will create a few thousand jobs. TransCanada has estimated about 13,000 construction jobs spread out over 2 years. A report a few years ago from the State Department put it at only about 2,000 jobs a year. But they did say that as many as 42,000 jobs would be supported by it. So in other words, in other industries. But once the thing is built and up and running, there's really not that many jobs at stake. Only about three dozen would be required to keep it going.
And what about the overall economic impact? Because a major problem for the oil industry has been that there's too much on the market right now. There's a glut of supply. And so some people have asked, why do we need these pipelines when there's plenty of oil?
Right. I mean, this project makes a lot more sense when oil is $100 a barrel, and it was kind of conceived when oil prices were a lot higher. Now that it's under $50 a barrel, it doesn't make quite as much sense. But that said, you know, who knows what the oil price going forward will be? It's very hard to predict, and we could, you know, conceivably in the future see higher oil prices. But overall, on the U.S. economy, I haven't really seen a compelling case that this is going to really boost the U.S. economy. Hmm. And that was one of the reasons why President Obama was against it in the first place.
It's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, with the news today on the Keystone Pipeline. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
This coming Tuesday, a DVD will be released, and it will bring painful memories for many, especially this time of year. It was April 15th, 2013, Patriots Day in Boston, when bombs exploded near the finish line of the marathon. That's some of the real sound recorded that day. In the film Patriots Day, it is ear-splitting because we're placed in the crowd as three are killed, dozens lose limbs. We're in the manhunt for the bombers, the Tsarnaev brothers, there as they wage a second battle with police in quiet Watertown, Massachusetts. It would end in a standoff around a boat behind a house where the younger brother took refuge. Patriots Day, the movie, is written and directed by Peter Berg. In this scene, shortly after the bombings, then Police Commissioner Ed Davis, played by John Goodman, and Kevin Bacon's FBI agent, Richard DeLaurier, debate whether to call it a terrorist act.
Gentlemen, the moment we label this terrorism, everything changes. It's not about Boston anymore. It's not a local investigation. It's Wolf Blitzer. It's stock markets. It's politicians. Knee-jerk reactions, anti-Muslim backlash. And what if we're wrong? I mean, there's no take-back. I've been through this before.
If we don't call what we already know it is, and the cell is activated, and they hit Chicago or New York or Washington, what happens then?
The accusations are going to come no matter what we do.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you?
Good to see
nice
you.
Nice to see you. How's everything?
Yeah.
How are you? Pleasure. How are you?
Native Bostonian Mark Wahlberg co-produced Patriots Day and stars as police officer Tommy Saunders. He and Peter Berg tell the story of real first responders, real survivors. They even incorporate film of a real recent marathon in which survivor Patrick Downs runs in a prosthetic, greeting his wife and fellow survivor Jessica Kensky Downs at the finish line. Many of the real characters attended a screening of the film in Boston last year. We spoke with Mark Wahlberg afterwards, asking him about his memories of the bombing.
I came in town the very next day to go and see my mom and my family and see if everybody was okay. It was one of those things where, as you started coming out of the airport, you'd never seen the city like that. It was deserted, and it was a very eerie, uncomfortable feeling.
It's a lockdown and just an unbelievable 4 days. What was the most important thing for you to get across?
The strength, the love, the heroic acts of our brave men and women. Being a Bostonian, I always had my sports heroes to kind of look up to and put on a pedestal, but the brave men and women of Boston redefined the term hero for me in the way they responded in the face of this tragedy.
Your character, is it Danny Keeler? I mean, I've heard it's a composite of many of the police.
The two big inspirations for the character are Danny Keeler, who was put in charge at the finish line, and also Bobby Murner, who was involved and basically went on his own pursuit and was with Billy Evans when Joe Carr was eventually captured in the boat.
Bill Evans, the current police commissioner. And Danny Keeler, I think, was also instrumental in the search for Jahar and the Tsarnaev brothers. What is it that you wanted to say? Again, a composite, but here's a guy who his knee hurt. You know, he's having problems at home. What is it you wanted to say?
You know, these guys had never been faced with something like this, and they had seen quite a bit. But in talking to them and gathering how disturbing it was to be in a situation like this, yet how they just found the energy to continue to keep going and never give up, and they knew the responsibility that lie on their shoulders to protect the citizens.
They were scared. Your character looked scared at times. I mean,
they were definitely scared. I mean, you look at even the officers in Watertown; those guys had never even fired their weapon in the line of duty. This was something completely new to everybody, and then working with other law enforcement agencies, it was new for everybody.
It was a cluster.
Yeah, it was. And I told Pete it's okay if because there was really a lot of conflict. But ultimately, people came together and figured out how to work together.
In this scene from Patriot's Day, Police Chief John Goodman and Kevin Bacon's FBI agent debate releasing photos of the suspects when Wahlberg's local cop breaks in.
We need to release those pictures.
If we release the photos now, we have zero control.
If we overplay our hand, we may force these guys to react.
Gentlemen. If I may, right now, Boston's working against us. You know, that's normal. You got a murder, no one rats. We don't got that problem. Because in this city, when it comes to terrorism, everybody wants to talk. Look, you got a lot of people talking, but they're talking about the wrong people. You release the photos of our guys, sit back and listen, trust me. You got to start letting Boston work for us, I'm telling you.
The behind the scenes in Patriot's Day is fascinating, but the violence is crushing. Take the too soon question. Emotions still very raw. A lot of people have PTSD. People in Watertown where the shootout happens with the Tsarnaev brothers. We have a colleague. It was right outside his house.
To kind of just so you can understand how sensitive we were to all of that, when we talked about shooting in Watertown and reenacting the shootout there, they did a survey of 200 people. 199 people wanted the shootout to happen there, and one person didn't. So we said, okay, we're not going to do it there.
The parents of Martin Richard, who was the little boy who was killed in the bombings, they didn't want any reflection of their family in the film. That's difficult because they were at the center of the bombing. You know, what you did was show this little covered body with a state police officer standing there.
Yeah, and that officer was not going to leave until the body was removed.
Well, it turns out it's without showing something. It's one of the most devastating moments in the movie.
Yeah, well, I think having to see the movie, sit through the movie, seeing us basically reenacting the worst day of their lives, but to know that we honored their word, I know they were appreciative of that, and then they were kind enough to give us a picture of Martin to put at the end of the film.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, when it comes to other people not wanting the movie made, I was probably one of those people for a time, but then they were going to make it anyway. So what do you do? Do you just kind of hope that somebody else is going to get it right and be respectful? Or do you have, you know, dreams of somebody coming in and making it gratuitous and exploiting our community? That on top of the enormous sense of pride that I felt and seeing how my community responded, I felt like, you know, should make the movie. And the message of the movie is not too soon.
Well, it's interesting, just as a little aside, talking to one of your colleagues upstairs, he was saying, you know, I see it as almost a group therapy session. And that's kind of how it felt in the theater.
Yeah, certainly last night. I mean, the hugs. I've seen the movie many times, and I'm always getting emotional seeing the movie. But because of all the people that were there and everything else last night, I had a hard time holding it together. But I also felt like one of the greatest and crowning achievements of our city is how our people responded.
How about for you personally? Is this also redemption, a little bit of redemption for you? You grew up, you had a tough time. There was an assault charge when you were 16. You're now portraying a cop, and you were one of the kids the cops were chasing.
Well, now look, I grew up right over there.
Pointing out the window.
I got into a lot of trouble, you know, basically left to my own devices. I'm the youngest of 9 kids. My parents did everything they could to provide and just put food on the table. We were, you know, around and influenced by a lot of bad things. And I've been spending a long time working on turning my life around and redeeming myself. This particular movie did not play a part in that whatsoever. But I am appreciative of the fact that I can use my real life experience in playing these parts. And I think is a very fine line, as we all know, or certainly at least I know, from somebody going the right way or the wrong way and becoming a cop or ending up being incarcerated. While making this movie, I ran into a lot of guys that I hung out with on those streets that became cops, and I'm happy that they didn't either make the mistakes that I made or get caught for doing the things that I was doing.
The theme of love. You show Patrick Downs and Jessica Kensky making love before heading off to the marathon. Their feet are intertwined. We know those they're going to lose those limbs. But the love...
Well, the whole entire movie is about love, and love always conquering hate and good, always being victorious when faced with evil like this. But I remember Pete and I sitting at the finish line watching Patrick finish the race on a running blade, and I just spoke to him briefly, and I still asking him how he found the courage and the endurance to be able to do that. So seeing him finish the 26.2-mile race and then embracing his wife at the finish line.
She lost both her legs.
Yeah. Well, one of the heads of the BAA came right up to us, stuck her finger in her face and said, "That's what this movie better be about. That's love. You know, people in Boston, they're not shy. They're going to come up to you and they're going to tell you how they feel." And everybody said to make sure we got it right and to show them what Boston Strong means and who we are as a community. And that's why, ultimately, it's a positive thing.
Mark Wahlberg speaking with us last December. Patriots Day comes out on DVD Tuesday.
The governor of Utah has approved the strictest limits in the country for driving under the influence. Governor Gary Herbert signed a bill yesterday lowering the blood alcohol limit from 0.08% to 0.05%, lower than any other state. Here's the governor at a press conference yesterday.
I believe it is good policy, and that this new policy will, in fact, save lives. And I think it will move us closer to having safer streets and a better environment for us to, in fact, to conduct our business and raise our families and enjoy the beauties and wonders of Utah.
Reporter Nicole Nixon has been following this story for KUER in Salt Lake City. She joins us now. Hi, Nicole.
Hello.
So why now? What's the argument in favor of this bill?
Well, the National Transportation Safety Board has actually been pushing this for a few years now, since about 2013, and they are arguing, and the bill's sponsor is arguing, that it will save lives, and that's the main factor. The bill's sponsor, his name is Representative Norm Thurston, and he also argues that the 0.05 level will act as a deterrent, and if anybody has anything to drink at all, that they shouldn't be getting in their car, and with a lower level, they'll be more afraid to. They'll be thinking a lot more about it.
Still, there are a lot of people who don't think this is such a great idea. What resistance has there been to this, and from whom?
There has been actually a lot of resistance since it passed the legislature. People have been calling and emailing the governor. I think it was about 10-1 messages that he got in against the bill to those in support of it. So a lot of restaurant groups are against this because they are really worried that it will hurt business. People won't come out and have a couple drinks with dinner because then they'll be too afraid to get in their car and drive home.
Because that 0.05 limit could actually, I've read, be hit just with one strong drink.
Yeah, for women, average-sized women, it could be a little more than one drink puts you to 0.05. For men, I think it's about 2 drinks.
Now, you spoke with Michelle Corigliano, who is with the Salt Lake Area Restaurant Association. You asked her if the bill will have a negative impact on business and tourism. Here's what she said.
I can't help but think it will, because we are the first state to do this, and we do have certain associations with negative perceptions of drinkers. You know, it's already out there and it just makes it worse now.
Associations with negative perceptions of drinkers. Is she talking about the Mormon church there?
Yeah, there are. I think people have this perception that Utah is unfriendly to drinkers. There are some pretty strict alcohol laws here. For example, if you go to a restaurant, you have to order food to get a drink in most restaurants. So people think that, you know, the place is unfriendly to people who just want to have an alcoholic beverage.
And KUAR also spoke with Bella Dinzar, the acting chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, who disagreed with Carigliano. Let's listen.
I hope that people don't think of this as something strange to do, because with the, you know, more than 100 other countries doing this, that hasn't impacted their tourism at all. And also the fact that Utah did do 0.08 first, but the other states quickly fell in line, and now all 50 states have it.
Now, as she says, much of the world, including most of Europe, is already at 0.05, but public transportation tends to be more accessible in European cities. And I think of places in Utah where there are ski resorts that do not have, you know, trains to bring people around, or maybe even buses in some cases. Are people talking about the need for more of that kind of thing in order to allow people to go out and have a drink and not drive?
Absolutely. That has been a huge argument against this bill, that, you know, the public transportation here doesn't run late into the night. People will have to be leaving the club at 11 p.m. to catch the last bus if they want to take public transit. And also in Europe, there are pubs on nearly every street corner. If you want to drink in the Salt Lake Valley, you pretty much have to go downtown and make that drive if you don't live in the downtown part of the valley.
Now, this new law does not go into effect until December of 2018, and Governor Herbert has called a legislative special session for later this year related to the law. What are the issues they're likely to work on?
Restaurant groups, like we mentioned, are worried, and police officers are both worried about the implementation of this, worried about, you know, how it will actually go into effect and what the impacts will be. There are some concerns that if you get pulled over and arrested at a 0.05 level, that it could affect your insurance, your auto insurance, and that you would end up going to jail and having to pay these hefty fines at a 0.05 level. So he has called that special session later this summer. They've said, lawmakers and Governor Herbert has said, that pretty much anything is on the table with this, but it does need some tweaking.
That's Nicole Nixon, reporter with KUER in Salt Lake City. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And we want to note a passing. Don Wheeler, who was general manager of WUKY in Kentucky, largely when it was known as WBKY in the 60s through the 80s, died this week at the age of 87. When he was at the helm there in Kentucky's oldest public radio station, WBKY, as it was called then, was one of the first radio stations involved in the formation of NPR. He aired the first episode of All Things Considered in 1971. So we salute Don Wheeler, a frontiersman in public radio.